It's hard to find a filmmaker who's had such a string of successes like Frank Capra, such a pile of Academy Award nominations and awards, and of course fan letters by the thousands. His classics really hit the market in a big way between, especially 1934 to 1946. Among those big hits were It Happened One Night, which garnered all five of the top Academy Awards, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, Lost Horizon, You Can't Take It With You, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Meet John Doe, It's a Wonderful Life. And of course, when he left the familiar area of activity and went into other genres, he also had amazing successes. During World War II, he put on a military uniform and for the Army produced the Why We Fight documentary series, which is really a classic among our documentaries made in this country. Later in the 50s, he went on to television and produced a memorable series for children about science. And then finally, when movie making was finished for him, he went into the back rooms of his library and wrote his autobiography. It went on to become the most noted of all the stories about a career in Hollywood, a book called The Name Above the Title. So Capra is a stunning example of success, a success story for any number of Americans. It's an extraordinary story of somebody who came to this country at the age of six with a family of Sicilian immigrants. And his brothers, sisters, father, and so on, they worked in the brickyards, the olive oil plants, candy stores, and so on. But little Frankie got a break. He loved school, he was good at school, and the family let him pursue that little academic career. He excelled and went on to Caltech, where he majored in chemistry and the sciences. And then he somehow got into the movie business in San Francisco, began to write routines for the Old Silence, the Our Gang comedies. He became a director with Harry Cohn's second-rate movie studio called Columbia Pictures. And thanks to Frank Capra, Columbia soon became a major player in the studio game. When sound came along, Capra emerged as the number one producer, director of his era. Did his pictures make an impact on American life? We can think of some amusing little examples. When Clark Gable was in It Happened One Night and he took off his shirt and revealed that he had no undershirt, the undergarment industry in this country suffered a big dip in its profits, as men sensed that this was the way to dress. In Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, Gary Cooper, in the end of his trial, talked about doodling. And in that way, he rescued an old word from the English vocabulary that represented aimless scribbling. It became a household word. In Lost Horizon, he gave us the term Shangri-La, which has become so familiar in our vocabulary. But can we speak about a more serious impact on American life and culture? Perhaps we can look to The Negro Soldier, that movie in the Why We Fight series, that documentary, which some people say helped a great deal to break the Army's prejudice and to pave the way for integration of the military in 1948. But is there a bigger legacy for Capra, something larger, something that represents his contribution to our thinking in this country about individualism and democracy and optimism? We remember Frank Capra for his fundamental optimism reflected in his movies. He expressed a faith in democracy, a confidence that good people could reform their society and their government and make things work. He expressed a faith in the common man, the common woman, expressed in the movies often with the term the little guy. And these little guys and gals often came from small town America, and they went up against the metropolis, usually represented by New York City. He seemed to suggest that these little people could succeed to a degree, that they could make a difference, that they were not helpless as pessimists tend to conclude. He also reminded us in his pictures of national symbols. He had Jimmy Stewart going off to the Lincoln Memorial to build up his spirit. And he had Gary Cooper going to Grant's tomb in New York City. Critics often made fun of these representations and called them Capricorn. But his defenders said that Capra understood that sensitive nerve in the American public. He reminded us of our ideals, and his background explained, in a way, his fundamental optimism, that he was a poor immigrant who succeeded tremendously in climbing the ladder of success and felt, for good reason, to love his adopted country. We also see a theme in many of the Capra movies that represent this notion that the little guy has dignity. It's a staple in his storytelling, and interestingly, it's very familiar to us in modern-day Hollywood pictures. Go back, for example, to It Happened One Night. In that show, you see the handsome commoner, a journalist struggling without a job and trying to make something of himself, Clark Gable. And on the bus, he meets Claudette Colbert, who's the wealthy socialite, the heiress, who learns a lot of the tricks about real life from Clark Gable. Last year, James Cameron gave us a similar story about that great commoner, Jack, who encountered Rose on the Titanic. Rose, who came from the family and the friends of effete snobs, and it was Jack who showed her that her mother's family were essentially phonies from Philadelphia, and that there was essence in those immigrants down in the hold of the boat. But look back then at the trilogy, the famous trilogy of Frank Capra, Mr. Deeds, Mr. Smith, John Doe. There you see the humble people, played by Gary Cooper and Jimmy Stewart, people who reflect decency and wisdom and, in a sense, a moral superiority over those big town folk that they encounter. The villains? They're the media moguls, deceitful lawyers, and corrupt politicians in those movies. Now let's think of 1990s Hollywood. Remember, for example, a recent film, The Rainmaker, in which Matt Damon is the poor back office lawyer facing up against a team of very rich and villainous looking lawyers. Or in the case of Armageddon, where we have some tattooed oil drillers who express pretty bad grammar, showing a thing or two to the nerds from NASA. Or in You've Got Mail, a recent motion picture with Meg Ryan, in which she owns a tiny bookstore, and she puts up a humble yet noble fight against the powerful megastore of Tom Hanks. So it's a familiar theme, this notion of the little person going up against the big and powerful. We can't say that Frank Capra invented this, that he's solely responsible for this notion, but it's clear as we look back on the 30s movies that he probably did more than any director to promote this notion that we can celebrate the humble masses and their work and ask some questions about the rich and famous who were so often celebrated in the earlier movies of Hollywood. There's another important theme, interesting theme, that appears in many Capra's films. It's one that gets less attention, but it's nevertheless, I think, important. The women in the Capra movies, especially up to 1945 period or so, were usually strong. They were tough-minded, like Jean Arthur, who showed Jimmy Stewart the ropes around Washington, D.C., or that savvy newspaper woman, Barbara Stanwyck, who tricked Gary Cooper, at first John Doe, but then later came on his side and helped him to win some battles. Of course, later on, as we get to 1946 in the famous Capra movie, It's a Wonderful Life, we must confess that Donna Reed in that film is rather spineless. Perhaps she reflects that New Age America of the 40s, later 40s, when separate spheres were the expectation. So many of the Capra movies show us the little people battling the big ones and winning some battles, if not all the wars. But at the same time, we have to realize, of course, that Frank Capra didn't learn his lessons about life at the foot of Pollyanna. Frank Capra's movies demonstrated the problems of America in the 30s and the 40s. In his films, we see a lot of references to cynicism, problems of wealth and poverty, corruption, the problems of the Great Depression, bank failures, personal bankruptcy, and a lot of other painful subjects get attention in the Capra movies. In fact, frequently Frank Capra gets his heroes into such troubles over these and other problems that in the end of the movie he has to sort of invent a miracle to get his hero out of trouble. We can apply some, before I finish here, just a few critical questions to the Capra films and to Capra himself, and not just to praise him, but to raise some questions. For example, the democratic values that are evident in some of his movies, are they the reflection of Frank Capra, the person? This is a question I really want to pose to Frank Capra Jr., the son. Or did he incorporate these democratic values because he thought audiences would respond very well to them? He understood how to sell a movie. How do we deal with that kind of question? Another one, to what degree were these values the ideas of Frank Capra? Or were they the values of others who collaborated, who worked closely with him, such as Robert Riskin, the writer who was so crucial to the success of many Capra movies? Another question, why was Capra so successful from the late 20s to 1946 in capturing the excitement of the audience? Though even It's a Wonderful Life, by the way, 1946, was not a market success at first. It took years until it became much more appreciated, and today, of course, it's always seen at Christmas Day on television. But anyway, why was he so successful for so long, but then suddenly he could not get the magic ring. He could not succeed after 1946 very much in his movies. He couldn't touch the public's nerve anymore. Another interesting question. But the principal inquiry we bring up tonight is this one. Was Frank Capra's vision relevant to the America of the 1930s and the 1940s? And is it relevant to the America of today? I asked the young men and women in my university classroom, University of North Carolina at Wilmington, to discuss the relevance of Capra's perspectives for the 90s. And I actually taught a class there with Frank Capra Jr., who runs the movie studio in the town. So we're asking about the relevance of Capra's perspective for the late 90s. One student wrote the following, "Is this thought still relevant today? I argue no. As a member of my generation, we know that the American dream is dead." Another wrote, "I think that this populist vision is irrelevant today because people have lost faith in themselves, lost faith in the idea that they can make a change. People see themselves as helpless against the major issues that plague our country." So it should be evident there's plenty of room for discussion about the relevance of Capra's vision for the 30s and 40s and for today. So at long last, we get underway with our speakers. I turn to Lawrence Levine, who is both the Margaret Byrne Professor of History at the University of California, Berkeley, and Professor of History and Cultural Studies at George Mason University. He's the author of numerous books, including Black Culture and Black Consciousness, for African-American Folk Thought, From Slavery to Freedom. Also, Highbrow, Lowbrow, The Emergence of Cultural Hierarchy in America. Another, just a couple more to mention among the many, The Unpredictable Past, Explorations in American Cultural History. And finally, in this free advertisement for the books of Lawrence Levine, The Opening of the, I like this one, it's an attack on Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American Mind. It's a fascinating book. The Opening of the American Mind, Canons, Culture, and History. Lawrence Levine.
Thank you. There are several lessons that we should learn from today. One is that these meetings should all be held in California. I thought when you heard Newt Gingrich wasn't going to be here, we'd see the biggest exodus since the ancient Hebrews. But you're very kind to stay and listen to us poor academics. There's a magic thing that happens at conventions, and that is titles get appended to the papers that the paper giver has never seen. I don't know how that happens. It's the same problem with hangers and closets, I guess. But I don't know what the title on my paper, if anyone's paid any attention to it. I guess if I had to title my remarks, it would be Frank Capra and the Politics of Culture. Some years ago, when I was staying at a hotel in Orange County, California, I picked up the hotel guidebook and I read this. "Standing at the plaza at the intersection of Chapman and Glassell Avenues in Orange is like journeying back to your grandparents' neighborhood. That pleasant feeling of familiarity takes hold It's all here. The soda fountain in the corner drugstore, Victorian houses, park benches detailed in wrought iron, and it's all real. This pleasant fiction about our common grandparents has as little to do with Frank Capra's grandparents' neighborhoods as with mine. His forebears, and indeed Capra himself, hailed from Sicily, while the neighborhoods my grandparents and parents traversed were in Lithuania and Odessa, the South Bronx, and East Harlem. But unlike myself, I have no doubt that Capra would have welcomed this Orange County mythos. Indeed, Woody Allen, who came from my neighborhood, my hood, New York, Woody Allen could easily have had Frank Capra in mind when he created his 1960s stand-up comedy routine, in which he is in Alabama, surrounded by Klansmen with a rope around his neck. Suddenly, he told his audience in the nightclubs of the 1960s, suddenly, my whole life passed before my eyes. I saw myself as a kid again in Kansas, going to school and swimming at the old swimming hole and fishing and frying up a mess of catfish and going down to the general store and getting a piece of gingham for Emmy Lou. And suddenly I realized, hey, that's not my life. They're going to hang me in 2 minutes, and somebody else's life is flashing before me. That's the secret of America, really. And that's why it's such a wonderful story. Somebody else's life flashes before all our eyes, I think, all the time. Frank Capra, whose populism was always more cultural than political, was one of those forces, and I use this term advisedly, forces, that helped to fix this image of the idyllic small town indelibly in our collective fields of vision. And he did it, interestingly, he did it while hardly ever actually depicting this cultural epicenter in his films. This immigrant from Bisacchino, Italy, attempted to explain America by portraying another series of immigrants, not from abroad, but from America's small towns and villages, trooping into the great cities and immediately undergoing a cultural trial by fire. Thus, in Capra's films, we learn about the virtues of small town life, and I think this is significant. We learn about the virtues of small town America secondhand, not by actually seeing and experiencing them, but much as Capra himself did in his own life, we learn about them by hearing about them. A salient paradox of Capra's career was that he became one of the nation's most effective champions for a small town American way of life he himself never directly experienced. From the great silent comedies of Harry Langdon, which Capra directed in the 1920s through the Depression years, one can find in Capra's films, as Bob Toplin said, an emphasis upon the little guy struggling against the faceless, impersonal system. The individual is divine, he's worthy, he's unique, and he's the most important thing there is, Capra proclaimed. This belief, he wrote, became for me a fixation, an article of faith. It was such a fixation that Capra, in his own mind, if not in reality, transformed the intricately interdependent bureaucratic technological art of filmmaking into individual enterprise. One man, one film was Capra's motto. I believed one man should make the film, and I believed the director should be that man. I just couldn't accept art as a committee. I could only accept art as an extension of the individual. Another abiding paradox of Capra's life was that even as he himself lived the Alger dream, even as he struggled successfully to escape his lot as one of what he called the common herd, he learned in the process to respect the strength and the resiliency of the common folk. He earned in the process an abiding grudge against the establishment even as he joined it. And he made an apolitical populism part of his everyday vision. The strength of America, he insisted, is in the kind of people who can plant the seed, sow the grass. I wanted to glorify the average man, not the guy at the top, not the politician, not the banker, just the ordinary guy whose strength I admire, whose survivability I admire. The fact that Frank Capra grew up on the West Coast engendered in him a deep suspicion of the Eastern intellectual establishment, which he charged was more or less allied to the European culture than to the American culture. Film and the rest of the world, he complained, is either a pillar or the central core of the national culture. Here, film is still a dirty word, and Hollywood is a dirty stink pot place 3,000 miles away. Hollywood is a dirty stink pot place 3,000 miles away. That tells us a lot about Frank Capra. Through Capra's eyes, we begin to grasp a question which historians really haven't dealt with sufficiently, and that is why marginal people like himself and his boss at Columbia Pictures, Harry Cohen, were able to exert so much influence in a central expressive medium, which so many guardians of tradition spent their time denigrating. Capra has frequently been accused of anti-intellectualism, a term that we often employ loosely and extend to cover struggles over intellectual legitimacy, which is not quite the same thing as anti-intellectualism. There have been struggles throughout our history over intellectual legitimacy. Capra clearly felt that he was engaged in just such a struggle. I've never had a very good standing among American intellectuals with my films. Certainly sentiment is an almost verboten emotion with the intellectuals. It's perhaps too common, too ordinary. Perhaps it's too simple. The cultural significance of Frank Capra is that throughout the crisis of the 1930s, he reiterated the virtues of traditional American values, not in the defensive tones of many of the old stock Americans, but with an aggressiveness born of his own newness and his own marginality, and initially born of his deep optimism. I fell in love with Americans, just fell in love with them. Those goddamned Americans, I thought, they were so free on their own, individuals, not taking their hats off to anyone. If somebody got sick, they'd do something about it. I thought Americans were the gods of the world. Capra was less interested in what we have come to call Middle America as a place than as a fountainhead of American values, as a repository of traditions that captured the meaning of America, as an organic society from whose precincts the United States dare not stray too far. Raymond Williams has remarked that the only sure fact about the organic society is that it has always gone, to which I would add an equally sure fact that almost invariably the organic society has barely just gone, leaving many nostalgic survivors in its wake. Perhaps it would be more accurate to say that the organic society has not gone so much as it is always in the process of going, so that its disappearance becomes not a historical actuality, but an ongoing phenomenon which can still be reversed. I think to understand Frank Capra, you have to understand that equation. Until World War II, Capra was not merely lamenting something dead and gone, something one could only wax nostalgic about, but something that could still be saved, still be returned to vital health. It was this optimism, this hope, that gave his Depression films such dynamic vigor and enabled him to attract large and enthusiastic audiences. It's hard to exaggerate Capra's popularity. In a 1940 poll, more people could name one of Capra's films than the films of any other director. And there are lots and lots of other marks of that popularity. Capra communicated his message visually as well as through his plots. Masses, he once wrote, is a heard term, unacceptable, insulting, degrading. When I see a crowd, I see a collection of free individuals, each a unique person, each a story that would fill a book, each an island of human dignity. A significant component of Capra's genius as a filmmaker was his ability to find visually the individual in the mass. His wonderfully effective crowd scenes are filled with memorable faces which allow us to believe in the crowd as an entity in and of itself, even as we see it being composed of distinct human beings. I gave each of the actors a personality, Capra commented, a sense of being, a sense of existence, no matter how small the part, even if it was a walk-on. For Frank Capra, there were no bit parts, no bit people. What helps to make Capra's film still vital is that he wasn't merely proselytizing, he was also exploring the extent to which the values he considered fundamental could still effectively function in modern America. I think that is the crucial campaign Capra waged. He wanted to know the answer to that. As the names of two central figures of his Depression trilogy, Longfellow Deeds and Jefferson Smith, indicate, Capra's heroes are composites of the 19th century giver of tradition, Longfellow, Jefferson, with Everyman, Deeds, Smith. Their function in the alien habitat of the big city is summed up by a scene which many of you know in the trilogy's opening film, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, 1936. The hard-boiled newspaper reporter Louise Babe Bennett, whose nickname signifies that she has lost her sophistication, become reduced to infancy in the big city, lost her values and everything. Louise Babe Bennett escorts Longfellow Deeds to Grant's tomb and remarks that most people find it a letdown, a bust. Deeds responds, that depends on what they see. And then this small-town hick from Mandrake Falls, Vermont, proceeds to teach the sophisticated Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter how to see, how to read her own history. I see a small farm boy becoming a great soldier. I see thousands of marching men. I see General Lee with a broken heart surrendering. And I can see the beginnings of a new nation, like Abraham Lincoln said. And I can see that Ohio boy being inaugurated as president. Things like that can only happen in a country like America. Scenes like this are repeated throughout Capra's trilogy and contain the essence of his cultural populism. Babe Bennett is drawn back to the small-town innocence and unpretentiousness she, like America itself, has lost. But with the help of unspoiled people like Deeds, Americans could recover and redeem themselves. And redemption is precisely what is at the heart of Capra's films. As Leonard Quart has remarked, Capra was not concerned with the politics of social restructuring, the politics of revolution, but rather with the politics of conversion and moral regeneration. Deeds and all but two of his future films, Capra wrote, embodied the rebellious cry of the individual against being trampled into an ort by massiveness, mass production, mass thought, mass education, mass politics, mass wealth, mass conformity. This captures the core of Capra's populism and politics in the Depression. But Capra's populism can't be summed up quite this simply. There are other elements that help to explain both his appeal and the contours of his career. Capra's populism is ridden through with a virulent anti-materialism. His heroes care nothing for wealth or status. Deeds' goal is to give away his $20 million inheritance. Jefferson Smith spurns the political pork barrel in favor of building a boys' camp, a boys' camp in Montana. John Doe continually tries to escape his fame and influence in favor of resuming his career as a baseball pitcher. George Bailey yearns to escape his life as a banker in order to travel and see the world. John Rayburn has argued that Capra's injection of this anti-materialism into the traditional American message gave it a new vitality, a way of looking at middle-class life which doesn't make it seem banal, sterile, and purposeless, which invests it with vitality and style. Capra's populism is shot through with patriarchy. Capra, as Bob Toplin said, Capra knew how to depict women of independence, power, and dignity. He picked actresses like Barbara Stanwyck and Jean Arthur and Claudette Colbert, who exuded these qualities. But he also knew how to transform them into more traditional feminine roles. Thus, his breakthrough film in the 1930s, It Happened One Night, which most of you have seen, is by Capra's own testimony, A Taming of the Shrew Tale. In Meet John Doe, one has only to contrast the woman reporter at the beginning and the end of the film to see her transition from a proud, tough professional to a weeping dependent. In Deeds, there's a clear intimation that Babe Bennett will give up her profession to follow Longfellow back to his small Vermont town. By the time we get to It's a Wonderful Life, the woman no longer has a career. She remains in the small town as a housewife, and the film tells us that her horrid fate, had her husband never been born, would have been to be a spinster librarian wearing glasses. You may remember that scene. It's a great scene in that movie. Capra's populism was based not only upon the values of traditional small-town America, but also on its fundamental style, a means of communication, oral culture. Voice, the linguist Walter Ong has written, has a kind of primacy in the formation of true communities. Capra's heroes function through the spoken word, while many of his tough, cynical urban types are people of the written word, newspaper writers and literary snobs, antitheses of the oral hero and values and approach. In each of his films, the hero's ordeal is symbolized by his muteness. Longfellow Deeds, deeply depressed and unable to speak in his own behalf at his sanity trial. Jefferson Smith, in constant danger of being silenced by the rules of the Senate. John Doe, attempting to address his followers through a dead microphone. Capra's populism is white. I don't need to explore that much. There are simply almost no blacks in any of his 30s films. It's difficult to identify a more complex ethnic component in Capra's populism, since Capra was so loath to speak of himself as an ethnic, though he was an Italian Catholic. Who the hell cares where you were born, he commented in 1977, following a visit to the Sicilian town he had left 74 years earlier. I hate the word roots, he remarked on another occasion. People are so proud of their roots, it's sickening. Nevertheless, there were roots that interested Frank Capra, the small-town American roots that were his only by adoption. His creations were continually informed and shaped by his status. That is, when I say his creations, I mean his films, were continually informed and shaped by his status as a first-generation American, making his claims on the heritage. Nor was Capra unique in this respect. The 30s is really a very interesting decade for this phenomenon. I'm now going to block all the names. George Gershwin, Aaron Copland, George Balanchine, and the one example I will give, Irving Berlin. We see the beginnings of a process that was to become prominent in the post-Depression decades. The torch of tradition was being passed to, or perhaps more accurately, seized by the very pariah immigrant groups who were so despised in the 1920s and who by the 30s began to not only expound, but to explain an America most of them had never experienced for themselves. They became not merely the receivers, but the bearers of the tradition. And an interesting Capra counterpart is Irving Berlin. Born Irving Israel Balin, I don't know why he changed his name from Israel Balin to Irving Berlin, but he did. Born Israel Balin in Russia in 1898, 2 years after Capra, or 1 year after Capra, and who wrote, as you know, one of America's most popular patriotic songs, God Bless America, in 1913, not to mention his songs about Easter, the Easter Parade, and a white Christmas. Like Capra, Berlin had strong populist leanings, and his creations were immediately popular with large numbers of Americans. When God Bless America was played at the start of a Brooklyn Dodgers ball game at Ebbets Field on Memorial Day, 1939, the people in the stands and the this was not yet the habit in baseball games. That happened during World War II. The people in the stands spontaneously rose. Men took their hats off. School children began the day by singing the song. In 1940, both Democrats and Republicans featured the song in their national conventions and in their campaigns. Berlin himself refused to treat his song as a commercial property, giving all of the proceeds throughout the life of the song's copyright to the Boy and Girl Scouts of America. He was attacked by those who found it inappropriate for an immigrant Jew to write a song which combined the qualities of a religious hymn and a national anthem, which attempted to define America's relationship to God, and which threatened to usurp the Star-Spangled Banner in the process. These complaints about Berlin, and there were complaints about Capra as well, were eloquent testimonials to frustration at the complexity of a process of assimilation in which the assimilants can become the assimilators, a role Frank Capra assumed throughout the 1930s. If we're going to grasp more fully why and how traditional 19th century ideals and values have continued to endure as well as they have amid the growing ethnic and cultural diversity of modern America, we're going to have to become more conversant with the nature and meaning of careers like Frank Capra's. Finally, we have to recognize the ultimate pessimism and this is important, I think, the ultimate pessimism at the heart of Capra's cultural politics. Capra's determination to test the extent to which traditional values could be made to function once again in contemporary America led him to progressively enlarge the scope of the urban dilemma. This is why his films are so great. His rural hero faced. So in Mr. Deeds, Deeds faces parochial New York snobbery, cynicism, and petty larceny. In Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Smith faces the entrenched authority of the United States Senate, which Mr. Clinton is facing right now, and the political machines which dominated it. In Meet John Doe, Doe faces the massive power of a media baron determined to become a fascist dictator. He kept escalating to see if these values could be made to work, and of course, less and less could Capra find satisfactory or believable ways out of the impasse his representative hero found himself in. Thus, in every one of these films, there is something that borders on a crucifixion scene in which the hero finally learns that his ideals no longer work, resigns himself to his fate, and prepares to sacrifice himself. The symbolism becomes most overt in Meet John Doe when the hero plans to throw himself off City Hall on Christmas Eve, and the newspaper editor comments, "Well, boys, you can chalk up another one to the Pontius Pilates." The words crucifixion and crucify are used frequently in these films, and Mr. Deeds, Longfellow Deeds, informs us that his parents were named Joseph and Mary. But in no instance does Capra allow the hero to sacrifice himself. As Dwight MacDonald remarked of Capra's films, there is something very American in the idea of an uncrucified Christ. Indeed, in one of the five different endings filmed for Meet John Doe, Capra actually allowed John Doe to jump to his death, an ending which he found aesthetically and thematically correct, and it was both of those things. But he confessed that he didn't dare use it. "You just don't kill Gary Cooper. It's a hell of a powerful ending, but you just can't kill Gary Cooper." In commenting on Doe in his autobiography, Capra wrote, "We had shown the rise of two powerful opposing movements, one good, one evil. They clashed head on and destroyed each other. St. George fought with a dragon, slew it, and was slain. What our film said to bewildered people hungry for solutions was this: no answers this time, ladies and gentlemen. It's back to the drawing board." And when Frank Capra finally emerged from his drawing board to create It's a Wonderful Life, his first post-war film, his small-town hero no longer had to journey to the city to test his values. The city now came to him. And only an overt miracle in the shape of an angel named Clarence allowed him to even hold his own. The game was over. Traditional values were endangered not only in the modern city, but in the very precincts of the organic society itself. Capra had nothing left to say, which is why, with the possible exception of his 1948 State of the Nation, I forgot the title for a minute, he never was to make another important film. I don't think he lost his powers. He lost, in a way, his voice. Capra had grave doubts about and criticisms of large-scale corporate enterprise, and in most of his Depression films, he found ways to reproach powerful capitalists for their values and their actions. Nevertheless, Capra's films seem to imply that the problems America faced were due less to imperfections in the system than to human fallibility, to madness, irrationality, selfishness, greed. The crisis of the Great Depression challenged the soundness of the system, and Capra responded, not as the populists of the late 19th century had, by demanding changes in the political and economic system, but rather by reasserting his faith in traditional verities and demanding changes in the individual. In his defense of traditional values and lifestyles, in his fear of the dangers of large institutions, in his preoccupation with old-fashioned individualism, in his search for community, in his concentration on the themes of regeneration and redemption, and indeed in many of his contradictions and confusions, Frank Capra was representative of many aspects of his time and his culture, and for better or worse, of ours as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Larry. I want to thank Dan Cotter for coming to the rescue at the last minute in this effort. Dan Cotter is Keenan Professor, University Professor at Emory University, and his books include Scottsboro, A Tragedy of the American South, When the War Was Over, The Failure of Self-Reconstruction in the South, 1865 to 67, The Politics of Rage, George Wallace, The Origins of New Conservatism, and The Transformation of American Politics. And he's got some long titles here. Anyway, we've got to get some spiffy short titles in, as well. From George Wallace to Newt Gingrich, Race in the Conservative Revolution, 1963 to 1994. Dan Cotter.
I'm sure the question that you're really asking yourself, despite what Bob said, is who came up with the bright idea of having Dan Cotter pinch hit for former House Speaker Newt Gingrich? If this were a real vaudeville show, this would be the point right after the announcement when the tomatoes would start flying and the hook would come. Perhaps Bob Toplin thought that since Mr. Gingrich was a graduate of Emory University, where I teach, and we both now call Georgia home, that this could compensate for the fact that, as he said, my views are just a little different, and I can't afford one of those nifty Newt Gingrich Trent Lott Republican haircuts either. More importantly, you may ask yourself another question: what's a nice political historian doing in the midst of this gathering of cultural historians and experts on film? My filmic experience has been entirely with working on documentary films, and limited in the case of Frank Capra to watching his films. This is the question, I might add, that I've asked myself on several occasions during the last couple of days. To make matters worse, I'm not even sure I know how to relate populism to Frank Capra. I think I know what populism stood for. I think that they stood for the free and unlimited coinage of silver at a ratio of 16 to 1. But I've been playing with the ideas about populism and how they've changed over the last 100 years since the People's Party bit the dust, and I haven't figured it out yet. But Professor Toplin has offered to make sure I get the same honorarium they had promised to Mr. Gingrich, which I understand from a reporter friend in Atlanta is now $50,000 a shot. And so even though I've refused to wear a Newt Gingrich costume mask, as Bob actually suggested at one point, I agreed to do my best. I began by asking what would, in fact, Mr. Gingrich have said if he had managed to avoid the recent Washington carnage. I'm not working completely in the dark here. He has spoken admiringly of Capra's films in the past. I've recently spent a considerable amount of time reading his immortal words, viewing his telecourse on saving American civilization. I hasten to add this was for the purpose of doing a piece on Mr. Gingrich, not for becoming a disciple. And in fact, he does mention on at least two occasions very admiringly Frank Capra film. So I think I have at least some idea of what he might have said. First and foremost, I think he would have embraced the conflict between good and evil that lies at the heart of the Capra films. In Mr. Gingrich's view, politics is war, the battles to be fought without quarter in the newspapers and over the airwaves. The number one fact about the news media Gingrich told his followers in 1984 is they love fights. You have to give them confrontations. And these confrontations have to be always placed in the context of good and evil. Now, in Mr. Gingrich's case, he has always tried to make each political campaign a battleground between Christian and patriotic Republicans who represent the values of decent middle-class people in small towns, rural communities, and suburbs, uncorrupted by the materialistic, secular, anti-religious values of the nation's urban centers. And here I'm paraphrasing some of his comments. He would also have shared Mr. Capra's suspicion and mistrust of the media. Every speech, every book by Mr. Gingrich is a lamentation over the pernicious and dangerous role played by the media in American life. As he argues in his most recent book, Lessons I Have Learned, the deep, and this is a quote, heartfelt traditional values of Americans are treated with a special kind of hostility, if not downright ridicule, by most of the institutions of the media. Their cynicism is like a cancer on the American spirit. I think you would have seen in Capra films a celebration of traditional values in many ways, particularly the family and hearthside. It's deep in the race, says George Bailey's father, for a man to want his own roof, walls, and fireplace. And community values. When George Bailey's dream and his hopes for Bedford Falls seems on the verge of failure, the people of Bedford Falls do not turn to Washington for help, and this is actually an observation which Mr. Gingrich made. They pour out their heart and their pocketbooks to help each other as neighbors. And of course, there is that deep patriotism. And here, unfortunately, my predecessor has used my quote, but to repeat it, when the cynical reporter takes Longfellow Deeds to the unprepossessing Grant's tomb and dismisses it as a washout, he responds with that eloquent quote about what he really sees there, something more profound, ending up with things like that can only happen in America. In much the same way, when Jefferson Smith goes to the Lincoln Memorial, he emerges spiritually renewed and ready for the battle to fight the good fight. One can almost see the part is played by Ronald Reagan, or perhaps even Mr. Gingrich. Above all, I think our former House Speaker would have warmed to the notion that one heroic figure can take charge, can mobilize the inherent decency of the American people, and overcome the selfish elites that seek to retain power against the will of the people. Though he might have been, I wouldn't bank on it, he might have been too modest to directly draw a connection to himself, he has on occasion made clear that his lifelong political goal has been to become what he calls a transformational leader who successfully mobilizes grassroots movements and renews American civilization by returning to traditional values. In a way, Capra film critics from the opposite side, far opposite side of the ideological fence, beginning with the leftists of the 30s through hard-boiled skeptics like Richard Griffith and Andrew Saras, they see Capra through much the same lens as modern cultural conservatives. For that very reason, they criticize Capra's films for what they saw as their sentimentality, their optimism, and their worship of middle-class bourgeois values. Above all, they recoil from, again, this is what they saw in Capra's film, his naive faith that the brave and courageous individual would lead ordinary people to respond to crises with affection, kindliness, and trust. As James Agee put it in a review in 1947, Capra's chief mistake, or sin, and he called it that, was his refusal to face the fact that evil is intrinsic in each individual, and that no man may deliver his brother or make an agreement unto God for him. Now, those of you who are familiar with the nuances of Frank Capra's film undoubtedly can see many ways in which these judgments, these readings, reflect a gross misreading of the subtle and complex messages reflected in the stories of Longfellow Deeds and Jefferson Smith and John Doe and George Bailey. I certainly see a much darker and more ambivalent mixture of hope and apprehension about the state of American democracy as it was poised between an ongoing depression and the rise of fascism. I don't see how anyone can watch the films of Frank Capra, for example, and see them as one critic, Elliot Stein, called them a kind of dress rehearsal for fascism in America and an endorsement of those ideas. But how do we read those films? I suppose one of the great appeals of studying mass culture of all kinds is that it allows us to get some insight into broad and often non-articulated attitudes within society. When I begin to read films, however, I find the traditional problems of interpreting documents sources, or as we now say, modes of discourse, seem to multiply. It's not just the dispute between those who emphasize the role of the director versus those who see films as a collective art form. It is the fact that most filmmakers, certainly those who are successful in reaching a mass audience, instinctively make a film which can be seen and embraced by individuals with quite different ideological and personal perspectives. We might call it a filmic version of reader response theory multiplied. Frank Capra certainly wanted to do this. I'm not a film buff, but I knew of his practice of trying out different versions of his film on test audiences to see how the audiences responded. Thus, Newt Gingrich can read or respond to Capra's political trilogy of the late 1930s in quite different ways from liberals or others who don't share his particularly politically conservative viewpoints. Broadly popular films have inevitably a certain chameleon-like quality. Having said this, one thing it seems to me is inescapable. However much we argue about the meaning, or to me at least, however much we argue about the meaning of Frank Capra's great films for the 30s and for the generation that followed, I believe, at least for now, they are out of step with our own time. I don't mean they've been relegated to the archives to be pored over only by film and cultural historians searching through artifacts of earlier generations. Films like It's a Wonderful Life still have the power to entertain us with their wit and verve and their complex sentimentality. Like any great creator of popular art, Frank Capra knew how to take the comfortable conventions of melodrama and stretch them just enough to make his audience respond with a mixture of pleasure and uneasiness. Still, we live in a world separated by a great divide from that of Frank Capra and his contemporaries. In part, it is that great divide between the optimism and hopefulness of the 1930s and 1940s, and even into the 50s and 60s, and the cynicism of today's students that Bob Toplin has described. But even the questions asked by a newer generation of scholars of film, and I'm certainly no expert on them, seem to be changing. One has only to read the critics, pro and con, of the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and compare them with more recent works, like Raymond Carney's American Visions, the films of Frank Capra, to see the contours of these different worlds. Critics who were unhappy with Capra's film, critics like James Agee, took them seriously as sociological documents, as representations of a world of power, or as evasions of a world of power, politics and economics. It's not just that we live in a different time in which the issues of feminism, questions of race, make these films somewhat outdated. It seems to me that under the corrosive gaze of postmodernism, these very realities have dissolved into discourses. Films which were once considered to be representations of reality have become representations of representations, gestures, visions which reflect the imagination of the observer, the one who is seeing the film. And so, for Carney, and I suspect for the rising generation of film historians, Freud, Derrida, and Foucault are far more interesting guides to this filmic terrain than Thorsten Veblen. The personal has not become the political. It has often replaced it. Still, we should not assume that this generation's verdict is the final one on the films of Frank Capra. I remember nearly 30 years ago when I taught a course at the University of Wisconsin on 20th century radical movements. On something of a whim, I assigned several right-wing radical texts, including I'll Take My Stand, a collection of essays put together by the Nashville Agrarians. As you'll recall, these writers, mostly Southerners, all Southerners, sought to defend different versions of the conservative agrarian South against the onslaught of Yankee modernism. The students which I had in that class were mostly liberal to radical. I assumed they would be appalled and disgusted. But to my amazement, they were more fascinated with this book than any of the other eight that I signed. No, they assured me they didn't like the implicit racism. Yes, it was, the essays were unrealistic, hopelessly romantic in their view of the South, but they responded to the author's outspoken anti-materialism, their reflections on spiritual values, even wrong-headed spiritual values, their search, their desperate search for community, and their criticism of what these students saw as their own parents' embrace of bourgeois comforts, an embrace brought at the cost of the worship of the dehumanizing machinery of the modern age. In his collection of essays and reviews on Frank Capra's film published in 1972, John Rayburn described the way in which the generation of the 1960s had rediscovered Capra and his work and warmed to it, and some of the ways that my students at Wisconsin responded to "I'll Take My Stand." But that generation has passed. I would note somewhat defensively that there is a certain grayness to the quality of the hair of everyone who's up here. I won't say anything about gender here. I don't know what will happen in the future and how, in terms of how we view Frank Capra's film. I simply close with a reminder that our judgments, whether of history or art, are always subject to revision. Thank you very much.